So let's begin with settling down, closing your eyes, getting into a comfortable position. And let's take some long, slow, deep breaths together. Slowing the breath down while deepening it. Slowing down enough so that you can feel the whole muscle of your lung expanding as you bring air into the body. And then releasing that in a long, slow exhalation. And as we inhale, bringing in a sense of calm, focus, and sincerity. And continuing with this deep, slow breath. As we exhale, letting go and releasing with that out breath any stress, any tension or worry, any concerns about getting here or what it took to get here, and just letting that go. So breathing in focus, sincere intention, and letting go anything that's in the way of that. And with every breath, we're becoming more relaxed, deepening, softening, opening. With every breath, becoming more present. Softly alert. Letting the harsh and sharp edges go. And so we've been letting go our distractions with our breath, but now coming into a more aware state of our body. And as we exhale, letting the jaw drop and relax. Releasing the shoulders from up around our ears, just letting those shoulders drop. And letting the spine both lengthen so that our posture is more erect, but also relax. So tall and secure in your posture. And as you're thinking about your spine, you can follow your spine all the way down to your tailbone. And relax the muscles in your buttocks, your pelvic floor, your perineum, your sacs. These are all areas that we clench really tightly. So just offering some breath and relaxation to that space that is the seat of our being. If your feet are on the floor, just notice the soles of your feet and how they are being caressed by the floor beneath you. And then give attention to all the places where your body is in contact with the seat that you're sitting in. Not just sort of peripherally saying, yes, my body is in contact with the seat, but really feeling the weight of your body on that chair, displacing the atoms, the cushions of the seat, and letting yourself sink and become heavier in that chair, allowing the chair to support you in all of your weight. We don't want to perch. We want to relax into the seat. And just give a nod of thanks to that seat for being supportive of your body, of your being, as we enter into this long day of work. And notice how the chair itself, or the whatever thing that you're sitting on, is supported by the floor in the room that you're in. And again, go beyond the perfunctory awareness of that into the physical reality of that seat being supported by the floor. And that support of the floor allows you to even further relax and become heavy and take up space and be full. And in turn, the floor is supported by the structure of the building that you're in. Think about that structure, the beams and supports that hold that floor, that hold the walls, and how they in turn sink into the foundation of the building, that concrete, firm foundation, and let yourself sink into that firm support, that underlying foundation that we rarely give attention to. And then the foundation of the building is built into the dark and cool, safe and fertile earth itself. The foundation of the building is built directly into the planet. And so the planet itself is also supporting you in the weight of your body and your being. And so we allow ourselves to relax into that awareness that we are, though we are spinning on this planet, circling the sun, we are also being held deeply, and we can allow ourselves to relax into the natural law that we call gravity. So again, let the shoulders drop further, let the belly soften, let the buttocks soften, and allow ourselves to be held by gravity so that we don't have to feel like we might go flying off the planet. Know how safe you are. And so, thus grounded and centered in our safety, I want us to just return now our attention to the belly, to find a sense of your belly, your center, your navel, your belly button. That place where you were quite literally, physically attached to your mother's body while inside her womb. And I'd like you to see if you can just take a few breaths as though you are breathing right through your belly button, right into the center of your being. So moving the breath from focusing on coming in and out of the lungs to imagining it coming in and out of that navel, your center, your umbilicus. Now we are centered, now grounded, now relaxed enough to imagine that even across this virtual meeting, this virtual circle, that we can create containment for the work that we're about to do by connecting to one another. Some of you on this call know each other, some of you don't. That's okay. Just do your best to try to reach out to the others on this call. I'm going to say your names. And if you can't, if you're having a hard time connecting to others on the call, that's okay. You can just connect to them as I connect to you by saying your names. And so we're connecting to Jenny. To Sky. To Jeremy. To Allison. To Dawn. With Kurt and Michael and myself. And if you can imagine, you know, sitting in the room with you all eight of us in a kind of cauldron, okay? We're entering the cauldron of silence and stillness. And in this cauldron, in Caradwyn's cauldron of transformation, this is a safe, quiet, vulnerable, powerful space. And everyone here in the space creates it, sustains it, and keeps it whole. Okay? So there may be a point, there may be some points later in our day where I ask us to remember the cauldron, right? And to just give some breaths of life into the cauldron and reimagine it. Okay. So breathing into this space of connection. We've call upon Hecate, Caradwyn, Dark Mother, enter in. Shekinah, Kali Ma, Dark Mother, enter in. You without beginning or end. Dark Mother, enter in. Dweller between tomb and womb. Dark Mother, enter in. If we are to embody the power of silence, we must bring it inside ourselves. We exude it from our pores, the shine of our eyes, and the rare but precious pearl falling from our lips. If we are to embody the power of silence, we need to walk her pathways often. So often that the map and the path itself become embedded within us. We go back and forth along this path, naturally, like a hawk takes to the sky, just as the salmon is part river, we are part silence. And so we ride the cycle of power until it is undifferentiated from us, no longer something we study, know, or do, but what we become, what we have become, and what we are. So when you're ready, you can come back to your natural breath, open your eyes, so silence is the space from which our creative impulse flows. And creative impulse is another word for power. In silence, we touch the power that we call goddess, God, and we become attuned to wisdom that is our own and beyond ourselves. So the book, A Witch's Book of Silence, addresses some of the most pressing and controversial concerns of the craft as both a modern-day movement and a private religious spiritual system. The Witch's Book of Silence is a mirror for us individually and collectively. Here we see reflected our beauty and power, as well as our fears. Okay. So, you know, my promise for this workshop, right, is to sort of bring this book that's been, I don't know, I guess I published it a year and a half ago. And honestly, I really haven't reread it until this week because it was such a labor of love and power, and getting it to publication was such an ordeal that once it became a book that I could hold in my hands, I really, you know, I sort of held it in my hands and said, here's my book, you know. But I haven't gone back to reread it because I think it was still too close and too tender and too raw, and I was afraid that I would see things in there that I forgot that I had written, or, you know, errors in judgment or whatever. So returning to this book And reading it cover to cover in the past week has been an adventure. And I'm so glad that I waited until now because I was able to reread the book and be surprised by it and say, oh, I did talk about that, and I had forgotten that I said that. So I want to thank everyone who's here for the opportunity for me to review this. And sort of make it necessary for me to open my book and look at it and reread it. So thank you for registering and enrolling and being present for the workshop, because it forces me to be present to this body of work that I've created here. So before we get into the book, and we're gonna sort of, I'm gonna be working directly from the book. There will be things that I speak directly to, or quote directly from, and toward the end, toward the second half of the class, even though I've split it into three pieces because of needs for breaks for the body, during the second half of the class, we're gonna be doing some of the practices that are listed in the book. So I hope that on our first break, if you don't already have a pen and paper by your hand, that you will come back and be ready with pen and paper so that you can take notes from anything that may arise for you during the practice part. But I did want to touch, we can't go through the whole book, even though it's a little book, it's only 100 pages. It's pretty packed, full of gems and pearls, and we can't go through every segment. What I did want to do, though, was to open at the very beginning now and ask if there were particular areas that you wanted, that you hope that I will address in the class after reading the book, that I will talk more about, if there are particular questions that you have. And what I'll do is take notes while you're talking, and try my best to address those issues as the class progresses today. So if you don't have anything and you're just like, I'm just here because I want to hear what you have to say, Karina, that's fine too. But what I'm going to do is go down this attendance list, and I will unmute you one by one according to where you fall on the list, and just ask if there's anything particular that you want to ask me to be sure that we talk about today. So the first person on my list here is Jenny. And let's see, trying to unmute you, Jenny, but you're going to have to hit that star 6 to unmute yourself. Okay, that doesn't seem to be working. Your microphone showing up on my little dashboard is grayed out, so I'm not sure what's happening there. So the next person that I have here is Kurt, and your microphone is also grayed out. There you are. Hi.
Hi, Karina. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think one of the things, first off, that kind of stuck out to me at the beginning of the book, and I've been kind of thinking about and wanting to expand on a little bit. I think it's towards the beginning of the book, and you're speaking about, I think it's in the section with the difference between silence and secrets, and especially like in the sense of, well, actually, the specific thing was you mentioning the phrase "silence equals death" in regards to like protests. And what was funny was I was actually watching RuPaul's Drag Race All Stars, and they uttered that phrase, And I've been wondering, how do we embody silence as a form of resistance or rebellion? And how do we take that to a place that isn't, you know, passive or complicit? And how can we actually make that an active or effective form of resistance?
Silence as rebellion. And so how do we engage silence without passivity?
Yeah.
All right. That's a good question. Thank you, Kurt. So I'm not going to answer these questions right now, but I'm going to try to answer them over the course of the day, and I definitely have that whole piece about silence and secrets earmarked in my book to certainly go to that topic. So when I get to that topic, I'll try to address that. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. Next, I have Michael.
Hello, Karina.
Hi.
I thank you for doing this course. I think it's amazing. And I think for me, the big question I have is around silence and integration, especially around the work that I do. It's almost like there's so much noise that's around me, and I'm constantly putting out a persona of who I am, and there are parts of me that I feel need to be better integrated. And it's coming to that place of sharing what not to share, especially because, you know, social media plays a big part in what I do nowadays. So using or integrating through silence and when best to step forward, when best to pull back, and how that can help me become more integrated, not only as an individual, but as a practitioner and someone who moves in a very noisy world.
Okay, I got it, and I may ask you to say more about that when I get to that part, okay?
Okay, perfect.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can get Jenny on now. There you are.
Hi, can you hear
Hi.
Me?
Hi. Yep.
Hi. Okay, so I guess I'm just here to listen and talk about the book, and it's like, just in general, I don't have any one specific area that I'm interested in over another, so it's interesting to hear what people have to say and what they've picked out over other parts, but I'm just here in general to go over the whole thing.
Great. Thank you, Jenny. Good to hear you.
Uh-huh. Hi.
Hi. And then that. Then I have Sky.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just listening. At least for now, I don't have anything from the outset that I feel I need addressed.
Okay.
But thank you.
Thanks, Sky. And then, I don't remember if this caller is Allison or Jeremy. The Brian Wilmer number.
Oh, that's me.
That's Allison. Hi.
Can you hear me?
Hi. Yep.
Hi, everybody. The one thought that I had while reading through the book, and I found a little more answers to it in the facing fear section towards the end, was what the difference between keeping silence and not keeping silence when you're in a situation where you have like anxiety with other people. So that kind of blur that falls from your mouth, or the silence because you want to keep yourself hidden because you have anxiety. That was really the thing that popped up.
Due to anxiety. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
Yep. And then the next person, I think, is Jeremy. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Karina. I appreciate it. For me, I think the piece of the book, I enjoyed the whole book, but for me, being a Taurus that is 70% fire and air, my work as I'm getting older, I realize is more about embodying ideas or bringing concepts kind of into my body and into my physical life. I think I'm attracted to abstract concepts and big ideas and talking about, I don't know, things on an intellectual level, but I both hold myself, I think, away from my most potent work by keeping it there, although that's where I always seem to want to go. So I think the piece that really interests me that I would like to hear about is the stuff that I guess comes more later in the book that's about the exercises and the way to kind of embody this stuff and bring it into your life. And that both, I think, for me, you know, having a very active mind, and so obviously for me, meditation is a struggle. So I like some of your visualizations and breathing techniques for bringing quiet into the mind and just kind of physicalizing these concepts. So that I think that's the piece that really resonates with me and I would like to hear more about.
Yeah, getting embodied. It's big.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Oh, my God, Dawn, you wound up at the last person.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm pretty good. Hi, everybody. So the embodied part also resonates for me. I am someone who really enjoys my own company, but I'm even more than that, I need silent time to integrate. And while acknowledging that, I also often when I'm in a group, I know I need time to integrate and consider and find my words. And yet, part of what you said about speaking compulsively, I feel like if I don't speak in that situation, I'm going to go unheard. And so that is something I'm bumping up against right now in a couple areas of my life. And so I can maybe find some more words around it later if you need me to, but sort of balancing those two things and also the particularly in situations where silence is assumed to be agreement. And I am pretty sure in that situation, I don't agree, or at least only partially agree. And so that kind of, how do I work with that is something I'm working with right now.
So let me just make sure that I understood this part, this last part. So the last part you said was, being in a group where silence is part of the agreement, but I don't agree?
Where silence is assumed to be agreement. For example, someone's speaking and says something else, makes another point, everyone assumes that everyone there agrees. That whole, and that relates back to resistance as well. You know, like how do you integrate? And I took that to mean like social resistance rather than I'm resisting my work. But if you don't present an alternate point of view or a counterpoint, then the people in the group assume you're agreeing with that previous point being made.
Really, really good question. Thank you for fleshing that out for me because I didn't hear that the first time. So. Yeah, silence assumed to be agreement or complicity, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Great. Thank you, Dawn. Okay, let me make sure I got everybody. I did. All right. So I want to just sort of quickly go through concepts that I discuss in the beginning of the book around the cycles of power. So, you know, the witch's pyramid, right? To know, to will, to dare, and to keep silent. You know, these are the four, you know, the four steps, right? Or we perceive them as steps because when we are not looking at the pyramid, right? We don't see that all of those four concepts actually exist on an equal plane. They don't exist on steps, right? but what our mind does, and our talking self, our rational self, does this with all kinds of things, right? Where it puts things in order according to how they're stated. So when we say to know, to will, to dare, and to keep silent, our rational self automatically assigns them an order of importance, an order of action, right? So we don't really think that we need to worry too much about silence because silence comes at the end, right? Silence comes after knowing, willing, and daring. And so we spend a whole lot of energy on the knowing, the willing, and the daring, and sort of leave silence hanging out there at the end of, you know, as a someday thing. So our mind automatically does that, sort of puts them in a list, know, will, dare, silence, automatically sort of numbers them, and then reads that list, that numbered list, and assigns importance. So what I ask that we do as we think about the pyramid is to put those concepts, right, on an equal plane, right? To put them, you know, to place them in a circle the way that we do with the elements, the seasons, the moon phases, our own phases of growth and development, and the directions, right, north, south, east, west, and to understand that these concepts don't exist in that ordered list that our rational self mistakenly places them in. And it's just what the rational self does, right? There's really, we just have to sort of catch it when we're doing that. And that happens with all kinds of things that don't necessarily exist on a binary or as an order of importance, right? One of the ways of the craft is to sort of binary break, right? Is to say things are both and rather than either or and both to something like that, right? So sort of placing the silence at the end is, I think, really detrimental to us as practitioners, but also detrimental to the craft as a whole. What it means is that there's a whole lot of knowing out there for us to access, right? A whole lot of information, especially living in the information age, where, you know, information has become a commodity. Information is something that we trade, and we spend, I would say, the vast majority of our time absorbing information, right? More so than the human, than ever in human evolution. We take in more information in a day than our ancestors 100 years ago may have taken in a 10-year span or longer, right? Think about where we were as an agrarian society, or even a newly industrialized society, you know, without a lot of transportation. We lived in our small communities. We lived in with our families. We went to our job, and the information that we gathered during a time like that would have been really social information from our, you know, the people that we saw every day. If we were literate, we may have read books, we may have read newspapers, right? But for the most part, the knowledge that we attained was experiential, right? We weren't accessing the kinds of information that we have now. So, you know, in a culture where we are inundated with information and seek information constantly, right? The idea of silence, of like stilling the mind, of like saying no more input today, right? No more input today. Let me integrate what I have become aware of thus far in my day, right? In the craft, this information knowledge seeking, because it's become almost addictive in our culture to be constantly seeking more information. What it means is that we don't have opportunity, we don't grant ourselves opportunity to integrate, to embody the information, the knowledge that we have already sought out and hunted and brought home, right? So we have all this information, all this awareness sort of floating around in the mind, but it doesn't get an opportunity to become deep, right? To to affect us at a cellular level where the information actually becomes a transformational tool, right? So what that means for the craft as a whole is we have a lot of people who know a lot of things. Because the information is out there and anyone can access it, there's a lot of, I know these things because I read about these things or I heard about these things. But having information and embodying knowledge, embodying wisdom, embodying experience are really different from each other, right? So I can read a recipe from a cookbook or online, or over lunch somebody can tell me a recipe, and I may be able to retain some of that information. That doesn't mean I know how to cook the thing, right? Cooking is a physical act. It's a transformational, magical, scientific act that transforms raw food and ingredients into a whole dish that is both nutritional and hopefully tasty. But so having a recipe does not mean I know how to cook that thing, right? I may know how to do the steps, and I may have the ingredients in my home, but until I actually go to the kitchen, make the recipe, taste the recipe, and then say, oh, you know what? Next time I make this, I'm going to use less salt, add a little curry, okay? and it takes several times of repeating the action of doing the recipe before I can say, oh yeah, I know how to make that and I don't need the recipe anymore. Okay, and this is what we're hoping for as we become adept at the craft, is not just having information, not just having recipes or knowledge, but doing the practices that enable us to embody, to integrate the information that we have. And that's where the part about will comes in, right? And daring, right? Do I want to just be a reciprocal, right, for this, a receptacle for information, or do I will to actually do some of the things that I know about, right? And then gathering the will and following through with action, which is daring, right? And then sitting with the results of that, right? And so again, what I just did was go through it as though it is a step-by-step process. But what's happening in this process of knowing, willing, daring, silence, is that you also have to have daring and will to gather information, right? As well as silence. You have to be quiet enough to listen or to read, to take the information in. So these four steps are actually, or these four phases are actually present in each phase, okay? Sorry, I lost myself there for a minute. This happens. So, you know, again, the rational mind kind of immediately starts thinking that that's not really possible. But I want to just reference the seasons as an example. So it's March 10th today, and I think it was about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago here in New England. We had a day where it was 72 degrees in New England in February. And, of course, everyone said, it's an early spring, you know, and people were outside and they were wearing shorts and just, you know, happy. I tore all of the plastic off of my windows so that I could open my windows and get some fresh air in here, knowing full well that we were still in winter, okay? That just because we had a spring day, that the season had not changed, that the season of winter does not go away here in New England until the beginning of April, mid-April. We've had snow a couple days before Beltane before, right? And yet we have this spring or even summer-like day in the middle of winter, right? And then within a week, we had, you know, a giant blizzard, and then we had another big blizzard, and then we're due for another snowstorm. And yet, we're still turning the clocks ahead tonight, right? Which means spring is coming, the light will change. So all of these things can be simultaneous together, right? We can have a spring-summer day in the midst of winter. The seeds are still germinating, right? The roots are beginning to thaw beneath the ground. The light continues to change even though 18 inches of snow fall, right? So, you know, there's just a different way to approach things that we usually order. And as we speak about silence, which is ironic in and of itself, to have this whole book or a whole six-hour class where we talk about silence, right? To know that it took knowledge and will and daring to get here, right, to this class today for all of us, including me, right? So we're dealing in cycles that intersect one another. And we resist silence because it feels scary, right? gathering knowledge is just gathering knowledge, right? It's just gathering information, and it's good. We're learning, and usually if it's information-based, it doesn't scare us too much. And will and daring feel like a challenge, right? Like, I'm gathering the will, right? Or I'm getting ready, and then I'm doing the thing, right? And then the silence. Gathering knowledge, gathering our will, taking action, all feel very active. And then there's this silence thing that can feel, some of the language you guys used in your questions were, it can feel passive. It can feel like I built all of this momentum and now I'm supposed to sit still, right? There's a stillness. There's a quietude. There is a kind of passivity to silence. And that's just like winter, you know, midnight, the dark moon, our old age, right? This is a necessary part of what it means to become a fully integrated person, right? So the book is called A Witch's Book of Silence, and I really struggled with, am I really going to talk specifically to folks in the craft in this book, or am I going to write a book about silence that is accessible to anyone? And I think that the book is accessible to anyone. The resistance to the word witch and the resistance to the word craft will necessarily stop lots of people from ever seeing this book, unfortunately, right? So we live in a culture that really demands that we be on, go, 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 right? We have, I know I can, well, I'll only speak for myself. You know, I have lists, I have lists for my lists of things that need to get done in an hour, in a day, in a week, in a month. You know, lists for the household, lists for my kids, lists for my self-care, lists for the groceries, lists for the, you know, menus that I'm going to make with the groceries, lists for errands that I have to run, lists of classes that I'm teaching, lists of students that I'm teaching, right? And I don't even work out outside the home, right? Like, all of that happens in my space. But most of us are... you know, getting up in the morning, we've got all the things to do, and then we have to get off and we have to go to our job, and we do all the things that they want us to do at our job, and we talk to all of the people there that they want us to talk to. And then we come, you know, we have things to do after work, and then we come home and we have to feed ourselves, and we have to do a little bit of self-care, and we do a spiritual practice and try to take in some information and some news and figure out what's going on in the world, and do we fold the laundry before you go to bed. Right? And so we're constantly busy, constantly in motion, constantly sort of like paying attention to time, right? And what's the next thing? And silence asks us to stop, right? Silence asks us to take a minute, right? Take 10 minutes, take an hour, right? Silence asks us to go against everything that our culture tells us we have to do, right, in order to survive, in order to be sheltered, fed, safe, right, in order to be in community with others. These are all very base root chakra survival instincts, right? And the culture has done something with our time and our money, right? Our exchange system, where time and money are our driving forces, right? And they always feel scarce. And so we're always running in order to accumulate more time, or not run out of time, or accumulate more money, or not run out of money, right? We plan our time, and we plan how we are going to earn and spend both our money and our time. And silence asks us to stop all of that, to be still, to get quiet, right? And no one is going to pay us for the time that we are being quiet and still or resting, right? But with this busy, 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 run, run, push, push, produce, 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 there is a, we lose something very important, which is that stillness, that ability to wind down, that ability to review what has happened in our busy day, right? An ability to absorb the information that we've taken in and to think critically about it. So there's something in the power of silence that is that feels, you know, threatening. Beyond the, it feels threatening because I'm going to have to face myself in the silence, or beyond, you know, the more metaphysical, metaphysically based fears. You know, we live in a culture that doesn't provide or encourage us having the luxury of time to be silent, to be still, to move into review, to release, right? To let go, to get quiet, right? Usually, most of us are, you know, busy, and the mind is busy until we pass out at the end of the day, right? You know, we fall asleep with the television on, or with our phone in our hand, or reading a book, right? Even in those moments when we are supposed to be relaxing and winding our mind down and winding our body down, we're still busy, right? We're still trying to absorb just a little bit more. So silence for the witch is, I want to say that rather than silence coming last, that silence has to come first. And I kind of want to back that up by saying, you know, my first, I talk about this, I tell this story in the book, but my first lesson with my teacher, my formal teacher back in the day, both of them, one, the very first lessons that they taught me were about silence. My first teacher, I went in after going to a ritual that we attended together, and I just wanted to talk about it, right? I wanted to process it. I wanted to be asked questions, and I was very excited. And I said about three sentences, and he put his finger to his lips, and he said, "Shh." And I said, "What? What?" And he said, "Don't talk. We don't talk about it. We don't talk about ritual. Let it live in you. Let it transform you. If you talk about it, you take it out of the sacred place within you that understands it already." And then my teacher in fairy, the very first day, before he taught me anything, he had me write down a vow, right? Like, I will not talk about this. I won't talk about what's happening here. I won't try to teach it to other people. So before anything could happen, there had to be a contemplation of silence and its power, right? So I wasn't being asked to keep secrets in either situation. I wasn't being asked to hide things from others, right? I was being asked to hold them close, hold my information and my experiences within me so that they could work within me, so that they could work on me and in me and through me and become embodied so that they could transform me, right? I should not even look at my notes. the request or the demand, right? Really, I think both of my teachers made it clear that if I couldn't be quiet, if I couldn't hold silence, that I couldn't learn the craft, right? I could learn about it, but I couldn't ever be it. I couldn't ever, I could know about witchcraft, but I couldn't actually be embodying its wisdom. You know, the craft, on the one hand, if all of the information were to disappear tomorrow, right, if the internet were to go down, if all of the books were to be destroyed, the wisdom of the craft has always been passed orally. It's really only in the last 50 years that we begin to, you know, really write things down. That's not true. I'm sure that those ceremonialists who are present in the class will point out all of those ceremonialists and alchemist magicians from, you know, back hundreds of years ago. But the secrets of the craft, right, the wisdom of the craft lies in the laws of nature, right, and have been passed, you know, from generation to generation, from teacher to student, from parent to child or auntie to child. And if all of the sources, the written sources, were to disappear, the secrets of the craft are available in plain sight by watching nature itself, by watching the wheel of heaven turn in the sky, right? Watching the movement of heavenly bodies, the stars, the comets, the planets, the sun, the moon, by watching the seasonal changes, by watching plants grow and animals mate and human behavior, right? And in order to hear those secrets, to become aware of the secrets, the occulted secrets, right, that are hidden in plain sight, it would require that we become very quiet and we become very observant, right, to get very still and very sincere, and that we carve out time to watch, to listen, to observe, right, to take notes. When we are quiet, when we are watching and listening, when we are in a state of observance, this is when the mysteries are revealed to us. The secrets are only secret to us now because we have a really hard time with the capacity to slow down, to observe, to sense, to see, to listen, and to trust ourselves enough to learn. That's a really big piece of it, right? The trusting ourselves. So even when we have an ecstatic experience, or we have slowed down enough to have some pearl of wisdom drop into us, right? Our first instinct usually is to run and tell someone, right? Write about it, talk about it, share it. And what we're doing in that instance is seeking, we're seeking approval, but we're also seeking someone else to say, yes, I've had that experience too, right? So we're looking for approval, but we're also looking for acknowledgement and a sense that we are not alone, right? But there's something deeper in the silence, right? The way that I hope that people will take the practices in this book, that will bring us deeper so that we can both be quiet and silent and still and observant, and slow enough to listen, right? To open to those pearls of wisdom dropping in from our own divine nature, from the nature of the world that we live in, the nature of the universe, the nature of animals, gardens, trees, weather patterns, and the nature of observing other humans, right? Beyond that kind of stillness and silence is the stillness and silence to sit with and contain and hold the incredible energy that arises when these pearls of wisdom are dropped on us, dropped into us. When we have a light bulb moment, right? When suddenly we understand something, suddenly we embody it, right? Like, oh, I know this thing now, right? I know the river taught me something today, right? The next level of silence is to sit with that wisdom that was given to you, right? That you were able to receive. To be that cauldron that I talk about in the book, right? To contain that energy that wants to be discharged, okay? We want to discharge the energy. When we get hit with this kind of magic, this kind of awareness, these insights, our instinct is to discharge the power of them, right? To take the lid off the cauldron, to tell everyone about it, to write about it, to share about it, right? When that may be sort of the instinct, because that power can feel uncomfortable, right? We could be like, I don't know what to do with this much energy. I hope that you're all sort of remembering a time when you felt that way, right? When something became like crystal clear to you. And suddenly you're filled with the energy and the power of it, right? And again, the impulse is to discharge that power. As witches, we have to train ourselves to contain that power, to not discharge it, but to become, we are both the container and that which is contained, right? So as the container who just had this charge of power come into us, our goal is to learn to absorb it rather than discharge it, okay? To absorb the insight, the charge, the electric shock of wisdom, okay? To contain it, to let it work its magic on us at a cellular level rather than immediately opening our mouths and discharging that into somebody else, right? And my experience has been when I follow that impulse, right? Something big, huge, something huge comes in and I'm like, I have to tell somebody about this. And I open my mouth and I try to tell someone about it. And I'm all excited and animated. And there's all of this power and all of this. I'm trying to get the words to speak the wisdom. And the other person looks pretty nonplussed. They look like they kind of look like deer in the headlights usually. They may be able to grasp a tendril of what I'm saying, but these pearls that fall upon us, right, or that we invoke or evoke, when we try to share them with others, it's oftentimes the other person isn't ready. Right? And so we also, if we're looking for acknowledgement, we may not get it. And even if that person is ready or they already embody that piece of wisdom, that they already embody it. So the charge really doesn't go to that other person either. It's just about getting it out of ourselves. So this is a part of the book where I talk about leaky cauldrons, right? Where we want to discharge the power. We want to take the lid off the cauldron because to be cooking inside of the cauldron, right? Inside of Caradhrin's cauldron, to be cooked is to be uncomfortable. Right? And we want to discharge that discomfort. So we take the lid off of the cauldron and try to share with others. So in the book I say, after silence, your own words pour forth, filled to overflowing with sincerity and depth. And these are magic. These are prayers that make themselves manifest. In silence, the oyster reveals its pearl. But do not cast such a thing before swine. Right? My teacher said to me all the time, don't cast pearls before swine. Don't cast pearls before swine. And it always felt like such a mean thing to say, right? What it means is I have to decide, right? I have to be discerning about who I share these pearls with, right? And sometimes that can feel mean when I decide that someone is not ready, right? It doesn't mean that the quote-unquote swine won't become ready, but maybe right now is not the time to discharge the amount of energy or power that we have. So when we share our personal experiences with others, that charge of power that's built up through having and holding energy is discharged, it's diffused, right? And we all know that feeling of like, if I don't tell someone about this, I'm going to explode, right? That feeling right there of being about to explode is power. That is the charge of power. And we use our speech to relieve that pressure, that build up, that charge, that power. But as witches, we want to contain, right? So hold on to the charge. Use it to make magic. Share it with your God soul. Integrate it and let it stretch you, right? When we are absorbing these kinds of charges one after another, we become big, right? Big with power. People will notice. They'll say, did you do something different? You know, are you wearing heels? they'll comment about some change in our physical appearance, right? But what they're really tapping into is a change in our physical presence, in that we become bigger, okay? The other thing that can happen when we have difficulty holding our power through silence is that we don't learn to keep our own counsel, right? We don't learn to trust ourselves, okay? There's a kind of ego gratification when we seek out affirmation, right, from others, or advice or commiseration. We long for that. That's human, right? For the affirmation. We get excited at telling secrets, right? But when it's all said and done, it comes down to, we're not able to contain our wisdom or our power. And we're seeking affirmation outside of ourselves because we understand that affirmation from out there feels good, right? We want people to like us. We want people to tell us we're wise or smart or powerful. But when we have to become the container, right, it means that we also have to give that to ourselves, that understanding, that affirmation that we are wise and powerful. And so sometimes we talk too much because we can't really stand our own company, right? We can't, we talk ourselves out of our wisdom, right? Oh, that didn't really happen, right? Maybe I'm just making it up, right? Maybe I'm just pretending. Maybe this is all just a game I'm playing. Maybe I'm really sick, okay? Who do I think I am anyway, right? When we sit in our silence, those kinds of voices come up for us as well, right? So there's sitting in silence and accessing our wisdom or having wisdom dropped on us, right? But when we sit in silence, we're also likely or certain to find out things about ourselves that we don't like, right? We may, when we get quiet, really start to get quiet and watch the sort of litany, right, that runs in the background of our daily round, we may find that our inner voice is not very nice, right? And so rather than listen to that voice, we keep talking as fast as we can, right? We keep telling our stories out there in hopes that they'll be mirrored back to us in flattering ways. This is hard stuff, right? This is this mirror work. That silence provides for us a kind of mirror where all there is to see in the mirror is ourselves, right? And that we have to, we are provided with an opportunity in silence to sit with what we see in that mirror, right? It doesn't mean we have to believe everything we tell ourselves, right? In fact, when those negative tapes or what I call the litany of doom, you know, the self-abusive litany of doom comes up when we sit in silence, it's important to just sort of learn how to witness that and recognize, you know, to ask ourselves, is that true? Is that true? You know, am I stupid? Am I lazy? Am I avoiding myself? Am I seeking approval? Right? all of those stories that play in the background, all the names that we call ourselves. When we move into the container of silence, we have an opportunity to ask, are those things that are playing constantly in the background true? And then we can work toward disproving them, right? Or if they are true, work toward changing them, right? So that litany isn't affirming our negative traits because we've actually worked on those negative traits. So our cauldrons can leak with this sort of wanting to discharge the power. Our cauldrons leak when we seek, you know, that ego fix when we share with others. In silence, though, we begin learning to trust ourselves, our experiences, our instincts, our magic. Okay. When I teach people manifestation magic, okay, when we first are taking our baby steps into spell work, right? One of the things that I tell them is most important is not to tell people what you're manifesting, right? Don't tell people that you're doing a spell for such and such, okay? Now, there's sort of a conundrum as a teacher because I need to be told that, you know, I'm aware that you're doing spell work. Your classmates are aware that you're doing spell work. But to not sort of announce it, right? When I was writing this book, you know, I didn't really announce it until it was complete. The books I'm writing now, people know that I'm writing books, but they have no idea what I'm writing about. And I hold that in my container, right? Because I don't want to be blown away or blown around by other people's opinions, other people's energy, other people's ideas. I don't read anything on the topics that I'm writing about while I'm writing because I don't want to inadvertently be influenced by someone else's opinions or their research or their ideas. And so when we are doing magic or manifesting things, there's something very, very important about keeping that close so that it doesn't pick up the influence of other people, right? There's a prayer that I say. It's very simple. It says, God, protect me from the well-intentioned prayers and good wishes of my friends and family. Right? Please protect me from other people's intentions, right? Because what other people intend for us may not be what we need. And so when we're just sort of putting our feet on the path of magic or just beginning to tap into what we may need to be transforming within ourselves or just beginning to work on a project or a goal that's really important to us, it feels counterintuitive to say, don't tell anyone. But don't tell anyone. Hold it close. Be the container. Hold that charge of power, right? So that you are becoming it. So that you can become the manifestation so that you can complete the project, right? So that your magic works without being overly influenced by other people's thoughts, feelings, words, and deeds. All of that stuff, especially if we are easily influenced by others. Other people's emotions, thoughts, words, and deeds will impact our magic. Sometimes that's a positive thing, right? But my suggestion is that we keep silent so that our magic does what we will it to without it being impacted by other people's will. So we're learning to keep our own counsel, right? To keep our own counsel. Somebody had a question about that. Let me just go back. I guess it wasn't. I guess that wasn't one of the questions. When we learn to be comfortable with silence, we learn to be comfortable with ourselves, right? And we learn to, as we know ourselves, as we get to know ourselves in the silence, we get to trust ourselves. Just like any other relationship, right? People will tell you things about themselves and believe them, right? People will show you things about themselves when they're not talking, right? They may tell you all kinds of things about themselves, but then they'll show you something, right? And when we enter into relationship with ourselves as witches, right? We learn about ourselves, right? If we're so busy running, when do we have time to enter into relationship with self? When do we have time to listen and to observe ourselves the same way we would listen to or observe a lover, right? Or someone that we are courting as a friend or a teacher. So in the silence, we learn to hear our own voice, right? To listen for our own wisdom and to observe what we do as opposed to what we think we do, right? I guess what I'd like to do at this point, because we're moving quickly through that first section, that concept section of the book. And we're going to start sort of taking a break in about 15 minutes. So I'd like to sort of stop talking at you at this point and ask for your input, your questions, your comments, your observations, what's coming up for you with what I've talked about so far. So how I'd like to do this is, rather than put people on the spot, is to unmute everyone. And if you're ready to share something, after all of me just saying be quiet and don't share things, we are inside of a container though, okay? So if you have something that you want to ask about or something that you need clarity about or something that struck you, please just say your name. Just say your name. It's Jenny. I've got something. And then I'll mute everyone else and we'll get you on the line by yourself. The muting part is so that we don't get everybody's background noise and the voices don't get echoey and sound like robots. So I'm going to unmute everyone. Anybody?
This is Dawn.
Okay, hold on a second, Dawn. Go ahead.
So what you've been saying about the cauldron and absorbing that energy, that flash, is incredibly powerful for me right now. And thank you for reminding me that this is a cauldron. It's speaking about it as an undoing, that knowledge that is dropping. And it's the beginning part of when I brought up the needing to process, and then yet feeling compelled to speak in a situation. And so when you said someone had a question about that, I could have waved my hand, and I think it's like, I think it's related to what I brought up about the silence is assumed to be agreement. And it may be, and yet, and I don't have the words for and yet, but we're getting there. So that's what I had to share.
Thank you, Don. I'm glad that piece about absorption hit the way that I hoped it would. Good. Who else?
Kurt.
Okay, hang on, Kurt. Go ahead.
I think what's really stood out to me so far has been the sense of silence as spaciousness, both in taking up more space to kind of hold your own counsel or to act as a container. And I think that kind of, for me, is bringing up this idea of being more detached from the outcomes of other people's expectations or opinions or perspectives necessarily on what you're doing. And I think that's kind of both, you know, this spaciousness that you're cultivating, not only to hold what you're doing, but to allow it to flourish as well.
Yes, because right, so we become bigger, right? And it's, you know, what I don't want to suggest here is, like, we want to become hermits, right? Like, we live in the world, we talk to people, we share information, we communicate. This is human nature to communicate, right? But I think that there's a question that, before we communicate, right, there's a question that needs to happen. Do I need to say that? Right? Why do I need to say that? Right? Do I need to say that, and why do I need to say that? The why, I think, is the important one, right? Why do I feel compelled to say this thing right now? And sometimes to sort of bite our tongue, right, and say, well, that's not going to add anything to the conversation, or that may be hurtful, or it may be harmful, right? But also, you know, of course we want affirmation from other human beings. That's part of how we live. You know, I talk about narcissism in the book. I talk about healthy narcissism and unhealthy narcissism. And healthy narcissism is like, we need mirrors. We do need mirrors, right? You know, if I am out there and I'm like so full of myself that I'm acting like an asshole, right? I need somebody who, hopefully somebody who loves me, right? Say, hey, you know, Karina, tone it down a bit. You're being an asshole, right? And then I get to sit with that, right? Is that true? Or I get to ask more questions. But we also need to be told, you're smart, right? You're powerful. You're beautiful. I love how you held the space for that thing, right? Or I love that piece of writing that you shared, or that painting that you shared. We need that. We're social beings, right? It's when we don't have our own core, right? When we, or we don't know how to access our own cord, our own core, where we know that we are talented, right? I know that I'm really talented at some things. I know that I'm really not talented at some other things. And when other people comment, oh, you're so talented at X, right? You know, thank you. I'm already aware of that. I don't need to be affirmed in that. But when we're learning something new, sometimes we really do want that affirmation, right? An unhealthy narcissist is someone who does not have a core, right? They don't have a core sense of themselves. So what they do is they basically throw stuff against the mirror of other people and see what energy comes back, right? And they begin to build a personality based upon what other people are reflecting back to them. So we have a great, you know, example of that in the President of the United States, who is, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I have no issue saying that person is a malignant narcissist. They don't have a sense of who they really are at their core. And so they're just, this is why everything is in chaos. They want to please whoever they're standing in front of, right? So when we ask ourselves the question, why do I want to say this? Why do I want to show this? Why is it important for me to speak this? If the question is, like, I just need to discharge energy, then the answer is to absorb. If the question is, I'm not feeling really secure about this thing, right? Will that other person's affirmation make you feel any more secure or not? So we are social beings. We want to be able to talk to people and have conversations and, you know, be a human being. And yet, I think that the goal of this work is to trust our own counsel more than we trust other people's counsel. Okay? So when I have a client or a student who is, triggered or pissed off at me for some reason, and they're throwing everything that they have at me, like just projecting. I have to be able to stand there and say, I'll take that into consideration. You know, like, I'm hearing what you're saying. I'll take it into consideration. I'll sit with my own counsel on that and find if that's true or not. I may even ask other people who I know and trust and who know and trust and love me if these things that you're showing me are true, right? It's not taking on the whole hit of their assessment, right? It's about trusting, like, I know myself more than you know me, right? So I don't know if that's helpful or confusing or what.
Yeah. Thank you for elaborating on that. It deepened it a lot. Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. Who else?
This is Jeremy.
Hold on, Jeremy. Remind me of your... Are you the... Okay, your data list?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, hold on a second. Go ahead.
Even just some of the things you just said really kind of resonated with some of the things that that came to me as you were initially speaking. I think for me, I think the challenge is, and I feel like even as I'm saying this, I guess I'm kind of figuring it out. Silence, maybe like a history of silence as a way of hiding and protecting, versus silence as a way of building energy. Being in someone who has been in a partnership for under 10 years, I think there's been a pretty steep learning curve for me of sharing and communicating more and not continuing to sit in silence as a don't know, a coping mechanism or as a protection mechanism or just something I just do out of habit. So at the same time, learning to communicate more and not be silent so much, but at the same time, being able to discern, and I guess the discernment is the important piece, to discern when silence is appropriate, when silence does build up energy, or when silence does work towards empowerment. And I suppose that is why discernment would be the important piece, is, you know, is my silence happening to avoid something, or is the silence the right decision to build something? Because I am somebody who I do struggle making a partnership, because I think there is a piece of me that the privacy and silence piece is important, but also untangling why, you know, is it because it is just a core piece of who I am, or is it because it's what makes me feel safe? So even just some of the stuff you said just recently about, I guess, I think there are probably plenty of times I take off the lid of the cauldron as a way to commiserate and connect or find affirmation when I shouldn't. And there are times when I probably should, to continue the metaphor, take the lid off as a way to connect and just work towards having a better discernment about what times are appropriate for each.
Yeah, I think it's important. You know, like, again, I'm not sort of advocating that we stop talking to people, right? I think I am, you know, advocating that we talk more to ourselves, right? That we find out more about ourselves. So, you know, sometimes, you know, in intimate relationships, you know, when conversations, you know, if you're sort of at odds about something and you're trying to come to a place of agreement, or you're disagreeing about something and things are getting heated, you know, I think that it's appropriate, you know, as long as, you know, it's good to sort of like set this boundary with your partner before you do it in the middle of an argument that you've never done it before, to say, you know what, right now I need to take some time. I need to think about what we've talked about, because I don't want to just say whatever falls out of my mouth. I want to come to this conversation empowered, right? And from a place of groundedness and centeredness. I don't want to be harmful to you or myself, and so I need to take some time to sit with this before I respond. I found that even with people who don't know me well, that if I'm confronted with something and I don't know the answer, or I'm confused, that if I say to them, you know what, I would like to take some time to sit with that and let me get back to you, people are really receptive to that, because we get it on some level, even if we don't practice it all the time. We get it, right? Now, if it's like a really super important time, you know, sensitive answer, asking someone to wait a week, probably not going to make them happy, right? But if it's about concepts or relationship or magic or power, right, say, I need to take a little bit of time to sit with that, and I'll get back to you, right? People seem to be very receptive to that. And I think it has to do with tone. It has to do with maybe not asking permission, but saying, this is what I need because I want my response to you to be correct. Right? So there's something that I need so that I can give you what you need. Right? Is that helpful?
Yeah. And I think as someone who is learning the magic and energy work that comes with your cultivating your own personal cauldron. I think, yeah, the discernment piece is knowing which, what are you serving exactly by the choice you make. So, yeah, that's really helpful. I appreciate it. Thank you, Karina.
Thank you. And I wrote down the language, cultivating your own personal cauldron. That's a beautiful, beautiful phrase. Thank you for that. Yeah. Anybody else?
It's Allison.
Okay, hold on a second, Allison. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. I think it was Jeremy, the conversation that we were just having based on his questions, been really helpful for me to think about my initial question about the silence that can accompany trying to interact with people in a social arena when you have challenges there. And I just wanted to say, like, this discussion is really kind of helping me understand the difference between silence in my personal life when I'm on my own or with someone that I feel secure and confident with, how it is, mm-hmm. you know, a tool for growth and learning, and starting to make me realize that the silence that can happen in those social realms or the lack of silence that can happen when you've got that stressor is, instead of an attempt to become bigger with this knowledge, it feels like it's making yourself smaller, like mm-hmm. in the face of a perceived threat, you know, something that isn't really real, but what anxiety kind of makes you afraid of. Just kind of stressing this out has actually been, like, really helpful. So thank you.
Yeah, it's a great way to sort of check in with yourself. Like, am I expanding or contracting?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they're very, very different.
It's a very different feeling of, like, when we're anxious and not speaking because we don't know what to say or we don't know what's expected and people, you know, all of the things that anxiety tells us, right? And so we sort of fold in upon ourselves. And I think in contrast, when we are holding silence as an act of power, that we blossom outward. Even if we're not speaking, we are getting bigger. Yeah.
Yeah, perfect.
Good. Yeah. Thanks, Allison. It's a great, great observation. Anybody else?
Sky?
Hold on a minute, Sky. And where'd you go? *6 on your phone, Sky. Let's see. I'm going to leave the button alone and see.
Can you hear me?
Yes, great.
I was just thinking about how... when I initially read your book, I was a little bit confused when you were talking about the concepts from the Witch's Pyramid, because I actually hadn't come across those before. And when you were talking about processing those things in a linear fashion, it all sort of made sense, and then as you developed from that into how all of these things are more nonlinear and cyclical in nature, I was sort of, when I first read the book, I noticed that that never quite fully integrated. And I'm having this moment now where I'm actually feeling an integration of how kind of folded into each other even all four of those mm-hmm. things can be.
Yeah.
And how in my own previous experiences with the personality that I have, how silence in itself has been an act of daring and will, or has been has given space for better knowledge, because in the context of relating with people, as sort of I equate silence with listening, just hearing what people have, and while it's something that I do very readily, I obviously that it's not something that comes very readily to a lot of people.
It's not.
But I was just kind of noticing how all of this kind of folds together. You know, even in personal conflicts that I've had with people around me, having expectations that I immediately provide some sort of input, or that I not take the time that I need. When you were talking about lifting the lid off the cauldron, the word that came to mind was impatience. Because when I cook, I do this. I just the other night I was roasting some vegetables, and every 10 minutes I was opening the oven, checking to see if it was done, knowing that I was just making it longer and the vegetables be done. And it is a function, I think, often when people lose silence, it's a function of partially impatience, either of themselves or in response to the impatience of others around them, to sort of compulsively not be silent.
Right, and that's what Dawn was talking about, right? Like being in a meeting, and if you don't speak up, right? I think the language she used was, in a group I speak compulsively because I fear being unheard. But if your silence is assumed to be in agreement, right, instead of speaking, you know, instead of being able to hold silence until you can disagree, I think that what you're saying, like, is a perfect response to what Dawn said. But go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's something even that has come up for me recently. I have a lot of friends who are much more, shall we say, traditionally intelligent than I am. They have capacities for certain kinds of logic that are societally favored. One of them in particular is, you know, you get into an argument with him, and there's not much of a point if you can't be basically more of a lawyer than he can be. And the thing that I've learned to do to manage that is to just refuse to get into that sort of rhetorical debate, because it doesn't ultimately serve a purpose, a conversation is not something meant to be won.
Right.
Anyway,
right. A conversation is a back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is all kind of, it's coming out a little bit nonlinear, so it's a little disorganized. But I wanted to share these things anyway. because they're coming up.
Thank you, Sky.
Thank you.
Yep. Where were you? There you go. So we're going to take a break in a minute, and when we come back, we're going to do some of these exercises, so be prepared for that. But, you know, this piece about keeping counsel. In the book, I say the ability to be comfortable with silence is the ability to be comfortable with yourself. Okay? So one of the many benefits of courting power, of the power of silence, is the ability to keep one's own counsel. As we turn our thoughts and focus inward, lowering the volume on our ego, we begin to see ourselves as we really are. Silence affords us time for introspection. Imagine that everyone you meet, each interaction, every movement and choice is a piece of information about ourselves. Everything we encounter, a bright and dark mirror for us, who we are as witches, parts of nature, and God herself. And imagine now how easily those reflections become distorted when we project ourselves, our neediness, our opinions, our self-righteousness upon the surface of those mirrors. We do this when we constantly ask others for advice, chatter idly, or speak powerfully without thinking. If everything is a mirror, and we aren't slowing down to consult with ourselves, it can begin to feel as though we are living within mirrored hallways of a funhouse. Everywhere we look, we are confronted with another reflection, projection, distortion. How, amid all of this varying input, do we locate our true selves? How do we dismiss the vertigo and find our own center? How do we escape the funhouse and locate our truth? In those moments, I would suggest that you close your eyes. Find your physical body. Find your breath and still yourself. Look toward the ground and open your eyes. Right there is your path. Keep your eyes on the ground so as not to be distracted by false reflections or dead-end escape routes. Stay focused in your center. This is your escape from the funhouse. Here is your salvation. The path always leads back to your center, your truth, and your power. So, Kurt had asked about the silence as resistance and rebellion. How do we engage silence without being passive? And I think that I want to address this now so that I don't forget to address it. That what we're trying to get to is that when we build our power through silence, when we speak, when we rebel, when we resist, that we are coming from a place of power, okay? We are coming from a place of embodied power rather than just yelling. Okay. So here's the thing. I recently went to the Women's March in my town. There's thousands of people. It was the biggest march ever in the history of marches in Northampton, which is known for having marches all the time. And like I said, there are marches here all the time. Like, there isn't a week that goes by that there aren't two gatherings on the steps of the city hall, which is right across from my house. So I'm always aware that it's happening. And I'm aware because I hear the chanting, right? Hey, hey, ho, ho, whatever our problem today is, got to go, right? And I think, where is the rebellion in that? There's noise. They're making noise. They're showing up with their bodies. They're saying things. But here we are in a town where everybody agrees. And there's the same 75 people showing up, yelling the same chant with a different inserted problem. And I don't know how effective that supposed act of resistance is. So what I, you know, I'm an observer, and I'm a cynic, and I have ideas, but I don't have the will to be that kind of leader. But I would really love to see marches and resistance and rebellion that means something more than just walking out the door with a sign, shaking our fist in the air. I want to see people who are not just saying no to what we don't want, but have been calm and centered and grounded and silent enough to develop solutions, to develop actions that are meaningful and actually change something, right? There's a place for the yelling and the holding signs and the shaking the fist in the air. I'm not saying that there isn't. But what I'm bringing the conversation back to the power that builds in silence, okay? That we become big. We become filled with conviction, okay, which is a really powerful word. To be filled with conviction means to be convinced, right? And we become convinced when we have studied something and we have turned it over in our minds and we've prayed about it and we've done the magic for it, we've been devotional about it, and then our words have weight, okay? Then our words mean something. You know, people who are I forget the language that I used in the book. I just ran across it. Who are verbally prolific? who are verbally sort of compulsive, right? You stop listening to them because their words don't have any weight. They're just talking, talking, talking. Sometimes they don't even know that they're talking, right? They're just talking to fill space because they're so nervous, right? But when your language is chosen purposefully, right, and your words match your emotions, your thoughts, and your deeds, then you wind up with, you know, the word of honor that I talk about at the end of the book, right? Word of honor, this is my truth, right? And that is the language that we need to hear. That is the energy that we need to be steeped in our resistance and in our rebellion. So I hope that that answers that question for you. Silence, not saying anything in the face of injustice. Yes, it's death. But just making noise, I don't know how helpful that is either, right? So we are at 1:45 on Eastern Standard Time, so it's quarter of the hour wherever we are. The break that I have scheduled now is actually a 20-minute break because I'm expecting that people need to get some food in your body as well. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to, I would like there to be different recordings for these different parts of the work. So I'm going to stop the recording.